Good evening, everybody, and a Texas welcome to the world of Kabbalah, the first JLI course of the new season. So welcome back to those who are existing students of JLI, and if you can please, if I can trouble you, to raise your hand if this is your first ever JLI course. Very nice, very nice. A nice nice showing. So we welcome all of you. Heveinu shalom aleichem. Heveinu shalom aleichem. Heveinu shalom aleichem. Heveinu shalom, shalom, shalom aleichem. We're delighted to have each of you here tonight. So as you would imagine, our first order of business tonight, even if it wasn't in previous JLI courses, is to take a moment of prayer on behalf of our brothers and sisters in the Holy Land of Israel. We'll pray for all the families who were impacted by the October 7th events. We'll pray for the soldiers of the IDF who are sacrificing their life to protect the people of Israel. And we'll keep in mind especially the hostages, and we'll pray that they return home safe and sound to their families. I'm going to recite chapter 121 of Psalms. I'll do it first in Hebrew and then in English. If you're familiar with it, feel free to read along with me. Shir lamalot esa einai el haharim me'ayin yavo ezri. Ezri me'im Adonai osei shamayim ba'aretz. Al yitein lamot raglecha al yanum shomrecha. Hine lo yanum velo yishan shomer Yisrael. Adonai shomrecha, Adonai tzilcha, ayad yiminecha. Yomam hashemesh leyakeka ve'erech balela. Adonai yishmorcha mikol ra yishmer es nefshecha. Adonai yishmer tzeischa ve'yecha mi'ata v'yad elam. And now in English, a song of ascent. I lift my eyes to the mountains. From where will my help come? My help will come from the Lord, maker of heaven and earth. He will not let your foot falter. Your guardian does not slumber. Indeed, the guardian of Israel neither slumbers nor sleeps. The Lord is your guardian. The Lord is your protective shade at your right hand. The sun will not harm you by day nor the moon by night. The Lord will guard you from all evil. He will guard your soul. The Lord will guard your going and your coming from now and for all time. May God hear all our prayers. So the fact that all of you made the decision to make Torah study a priority is a big deal for a Jewish person at any time, but especially during this time, when everything that's going on in Israel and reverberating all over the world, it's all the more important to strengthen our Jewish identity, and we do so first and foremost by studying Torah and taking in timeless divine wisdom, which is here not just to study, but to inform, to inspire, and to illuminate the days, months, and years of our life going forward. So with that, there were three people. How did you know it's coming? You're laughing already. There were a therapist, a surgeon, and a politician were debating whose profession came first. So first the therapist said, well, after the sin of eating from the tree of knowledge, there was some marital discord going on over there. There was blaming each other, etc. So the therapist said, that was the first one that was necessary. The surgeon speaks up and says, actually, how do you think Eve was created from Adam? It was through surgery. She had to be, she was created from Adam's rib, Adam's side. So I was even before you. The politician speaks up and said, actually, right in the beginning, it says that the world and the universe was full of chaos. Who do you think created the chaos? So, welcome once again to the world of Kabbalah. Here's your opportunity, your once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to become a trained Jewish mystic. Tonight, we're going to be focusing on the first of six sessions. Tonight is called The Evolution of Ego. And we'll begin by asking each of you to just call out what word comes to mind when you think Kabbalah. What's the first thing that comes to mind? Go.
Mysticism.
Sphirot. Good.
Madonna.
Who is that?
Madonna.
Okay. What else? Anything else?
Hasidic.
Okay. So,
desire.
All right. Good one. Wonderful. Yes.
Tzfat.
Great one. The mystical city. All right. Wonderful responses. And we're going to be learning a lot over the next six Mondays, starting tonight. And most certainly, Kabbalah does conjure up and invokes a lot of fascination, a lot of interest, intrigue, and that's all true. And hopefully, throughout this course, and after this course, we'll all become a lot more familiar with this topic. Of course, authentic Kabbalah familiarity, hopefully, as a result. So we're going to be addressing tonight a number of questions that we're going to be putting up, which you'll see on the screen, the driving questions of tonight's session. And those will be, number one, what is Kabbalah? We'll talk about. Number two, what are its central teachings? And then, what is the significance of some of its key terms, like Sphirot? And then, how are these teachings relevant to my everyday life? So these are some of the things we'll be addressing tonight. And the last question of how are these ideas and these teachings relevant to my everyday life, that's a really important one. Because in Judaism, we believe that any transcendent experience, any meditation, any contemplation, anything transcendent that one pursues usually is not in, it's not with an end in and of itself. It's always for a purpose, and the question is what comes after. Whenever we study something esoteric, mystical, of course the experience itself has value, but there's another question of what are we then doing with that information? How is that information, or how is that transcendent experience going to then inform my life after or as a result of knowing this information? So this is really a key question, because unlike in other religions, perhaps, where just transcendence alone is a goal in and of itself, in Judaism it's never that way. It's all about what comes after. It's all about, in Hasidic terminology we say, what in Hebrew we say, what is the bechein? Like, and therefore, it's very nice. You had a very impressive transcendent experience. But, and then what? How is that going to enhance your life as a Jew, as a human being, going forward? And that is the question that we always need to ask ourselves, because, as we all know from the famous dream that Jacob had, Jewish mysticism is not for spiritual enlightenment as an end in itself. Yes, we do climb the ladder of spiritual enlightenment, but it's always with the purpose. It's to shift perspective and empower growth. Always. So if somebody had a very powerful, you know, just an inspiring experience in itself is not that impressive. It's always the question we always need to ask ourselves afterwards is what are we bringing back home from that inspiring experience. That's true about anything we experience in life, even Yom Kippur. Even having a sacred day of Yom Kippur in synagogue and fasting and praying, and it's super spiritual. But the question is really, what did we bring home from synagogue after a day spent in prayer and reflection, etc.? So that's certainly true when we talk about the study of Kabbalah, the study of Jewish spirituality. Okay, so far so good. So just a few more points, which are kind of going to be more introductory points before we get into the meat of tonight's discussion. That was one very important point, that it's always about what comes next. And I want to introduce you. If you open up your student book, I think it's like a page or two from the front, you'll find a map, actually. I'm going to use this one right here. This map is going to be very valuable to you for this entire course. Tonight, we're not going to be really delving into specifics of this map, but I do want to call your attention to the right side specifically, which is called on top in the divine image. And I just want you to just see this very generally. And I also wanted you to know that the map is there in case we need to make further reference to it. But I'm going to leave mine on the side right now. And what I really want you to see is the fact that there is a diagram. You see a Kabbalah diagram? By the raise of hand, how many of you have seen this before? Okay, it looks like a nice number of you. So these diagrams, the one on figure 1.2, was authored by Rabbi Moshe Cordovero, a very well-known Kabbalist, known as the Ramak by the acronym of his name, 16th century Kabbalist. And he also lived in Tzfat, by the way. I don't think he was born there, or he originated in Spain, actually, but he did live in Tzfat. And the other one was by Rabbi Shabtai Shechtel Halevi Horowitz, 15th and 16th century Kabbalist and rabbi. And he was a resident of Prague, and he authored this one. So the question is, and again, we can put it aside for now, but the question that I want to address right now is, why do we even have these diagrams? What do they even convey? Forget about the specifics of them, which we'll be revisiting. Just generally speaking, why do we even have them? And the answer is, right there in text number one, can I ask, by the way, just to let you know, I'm going to ask, we kind of move around the room to read short texts, usually. If you're up to it, you can read. If you don't want to, feel free to just pass the microphone to the person next to you. That's not a problem. So text number one is on page 6 in your student book. And Phyllis, would you like to read that for us, please?
In English, I hope.
In English, yes. All texts in English.
A mortal is a mirror for the supernal reality. All that exists in both higher and lower realms is present in microcosmic form within the human. This is the deeper significance of the Torah statement that the human was created in the divine image, Genesis 1:27, and this is why we say, from my flesh I envision God.
Thank you. Very important words here. Number one, we're all familiar with the statement that man was created in the image of God. So that's number one. Just like a child born to parents has a lot of characteristic of the parents, whether we like it or not, they have it. Similarly, a soul that comes from God has characteristics of God. So that's for starters. And Job said in these three words in Hebrew, he said, from my flesh I envision God. Now, what he meant on a literal level was just that from his space, from the way he exists in his flesh, he envisions God. But there's a deeper meaning to his words. And that is that if you want to get to know God, you can do so from looking at yourself. This is the deeper meaning of those words. From my flesh, I envision God means that if we explore ourself, and if we explore our own characteristics and our own makeup, we'll be able to understand and appreciate God from looking at ourselves. And that's, of course, because we are created in the image of God. And this is why we have these diagrams. These diagrams are there to help us understand God better, different characteristics about God. And we do so from studying and exploring the human being to a greater extent. Okay. So far, so good? All right. Now, let's talk about this for a little bit. I imagine everybody at some point, even if you don't today, but you've either owned a home or built a home, right? Everybody? Okay. So, whenever that was, whenever you decided that you want to either acquire or get yourself a home, so how did it start? What was like the first thought? If anyone wants to speak up, feel free. Yes?
You evaluate your finances.
Okay, you wake up one morning and start evaluating, or there's something before that?
You start saving with a plan.
But what about before that?
You perceive a need.
Perceive a need.
I think there's a desire to have a home.
A desire, okay. Desire is great. So yeah, it starts with a desire, right? We do end up needing savings, most certainly, but we start with a desire. Now, is that all? Does it originate within the desire?
You can be dissatisfied with what you have now.
Okay, we're getting there. We're inching closer. There's a dissatisfaction with what you have now. In other words, and this is what Kabbalah teaches, that every desire is driven by something else. And that something else is what Kabbalah refers to as pleasure. Meaning, I imagine the pleasure of having a home. That's the origin of this whole process. The hierarchy of me acquiring a home or building a home, whatever the path is going to be, but until I actually have the home, how does it start? It starts from there's deep inside, at my core essence, there's a pleasure that I developed in wanting to have a home. The pleasure then motivates the desire. Just like if somebody, you're at someone's Shabbat dinner table and dessert comes out and there's two options. There's vanilla and chocolate ice cream. And someone asks you, which one do you want? And you say,
strawberry.
You're gonna go without dessert that night. So you're going to say vanilla. And someone's going to ask you, why? Well, is there an answer to that question? Because that's what I like. There's no why. Because I like vanilla. So what's behind it all is the fact that this is what you like. And there's a saying in Yiddish, which Kabbalah actually quotes, well, Hasidic philosophy does, to be precise, in the Yiddish, and that is, if a taiva is kenkasha, you can't ask a question on why someone has a desire. Because they want it. And this is where they find pleasure. So that's really what motivates. That's the really at the core that's motivating a desire. So again, we're talking about the house. So it starts from pleasure. Then that kind of gives birth or makes room for a desire for a house. And then what happens next? Then you start to use your intellect. You start strategizing. You start analyzing what you want your house to look like. Should I build a house? Should I buy a house? Where should I look for one? Which area? Which block? What do I want the house to look like? This room, that room, all these specific details. And from analyzing it and using your logic to develop the idea, then you kind of connect emotionally to the various different options. You connect more so emotionally or less so. And then you use, and we'll talk more about this, you use your thought, your speech, and eventually your action. You sign the deal and you execute. So there's a whole hierarchy of how this plays itself out. Pleasure from having a home is first, then you have the desire for a home, then justify the endeavor logically, explore how each option would make you feel, rethink the plan, speak it over, and finally a signature or handshake. And yes, somewhere in the middle over there was also a down payment and savings. Yes, it was part of the process, no question about it. Did you have a question?
I just wanted to say that I thought that the very first thing would be need. What do you need? Not what do you want.
But there's something even deeper than need. Yes, there's a need.
Pleasure. Is pleasure greater than need?
pleasure is the deepest place within the person. That's what Kabbalah teaches. And behind a lot of things that you see people doing, if you look deep enough, you'll discover that there's a pleasure, or they have a pleasure in something, and that's why they're pursuing whatever they're pursuing. If you really backtrack all the way to the core essence, that's what you'll find. But yes, maybe consciously it's more of a need. The pleasure is not always conscious, not always on the surface, but deep down it's there, and that's the deepest part of the person. Okay, so that said, what are we really getting to with all this? The reason why we're talking about this when it comes to a human being wanting a home is because the same applies to God Almighty. There's a hierarchy in the process. So let's say we all know that God created a world, but God is spiritual, right? 100% spiritual. The world that we know and see is 100% physical. So what happened in between? Was it just like that? It came to be? There was spirituality exclusive, and then poof, came this physical world, the material world that we know. So what Kabbalah does for us is it helps us kind of bridges the gap or fills in the empty spaces and gives us the ability to understand and appreciate that there's a process. There's a sophisticated process that's going on here. And this is a large part of what Kabbalah focuses on to help us understand what this hierarchy and what this process is like. From when God desired a world, right? God, why did God create the world? We're not going to dwell on this tonight, but God had a desire. It also started from pleasure, and that gave birth to a desire. God was all alone, right? It was only God before he created anything. But then God wanted a relationship. In order to have a relationship, he needed to create something, some other entity that he can have a relationship with. Because you can't have a relationship with somebody or with something unless it's a true other. It really has to not be you. If it's an extension of you, you're not really having a relationship, right? If you have an app on your phone and you program it to send you a text every day at 10 a.m. saying, I love you, is that going to impress you? Why not? You can have a relationship with an app. It's really telling you. It's not going to work. It doesn't do anything. It has no meaning. It has no value. But if another human being does the same thing and sends you that text every day at 10 a.m., that's a relationship, because there's an other that's choosing to be in a relationship with you. So for God to be in a relationship, he was all alone, he needed to create this other. And we'll be learning a lot about it over the next 6 weeks. Once there was an other, a real, true other, then now he can have a relationship. And an other means an other that being that has free choice, that could choose to be in the relationship or could choose not to. And that was the need and the desire and even the pleasure in the deepest recesses, if you will, within God's essence that drove everything that we know about God creating worlds. It started from pleasure. He wanted that pleasure of being in a relationship, which he was unable to have without beginning the process of creation. Yes. Well, God could, number one.
God could, right? But like with the house. So you're feeling a sense of displeasure from not owning a home and anticipating pleasure of having it.
Right, yes, you can have displeasure. The Talmud says if a person that doesn't have a home is considered not a person. They're not a man. So yes, there's a displeasure, there's a dissatisfaction. But what's really going to drive you to pursue the home is the pleasure that will be That will be waiting there. Exactly. Well, you don't have the pleasure yet, right, but there is the potential for pleasure, and that's what's driving everything that you're doing.
Quick question. If you replace home for a job...
You could say this about anything, by the way.
That's my point. If you said, I want to have a job, it's not that we're looking for pleasure with the job. It's a need. And I think that's where we're going with the question.
Yes, but somebody should ideally find pleasure. Well, first of all, there's pleasure in just being able to pay your bills. Ideally, you should also have pleasure in what you're doing, not just the result of what you're doing. But you can apply it to anything. I used home, first of all, because, you know, building a home is kind of like God building a world, but Kabbalah also does say that the world is God's home. So but it's true about anything. Okay. Another thing we're going to be doing in this course, in the process of this course, is picking up a lot of Kabbalistic terms. And I believe the other side of the map actually has the entire list of terms that we're going to be exploring throughout this course. And it looks like, I don't know, there's like a 40 of them or something. But they will actually appear within your book as well as we move through them. They're just also on the back of the map. So we don't actually need the map right now, or that page right now. But if you look on page 7 in your student book, the first key term... of all the terms that we're going to be learning. By the way, is it hot? You can, okay. If it is, I'll welcome it to be cooler. No problem. So, the first term that we're going to be learning, and if you look right there, you have it in Hebrew or English, is called Seder Hishtalshalut. We all know what Seder means. It means like order. But the key word here is Hishtalshalut. Anyone know the root of that word? What was that? Shalshelet. Anyone in Hebrew? Shalshelet. Shalshelet means a chain. Maybe there's another word in modern Hebrew, but shalshelet means a chain. Hishtalshalut means like a chain. Now, what's a, why a chain?
That's what you have on Sukkot, the decoration.
Yes. But why a chain? Because a chain, each ring is connected to the next one. So, what are we getting at with this term? By the way, can everyone say with me? I'm going to say it slow first. Hishtalshalut. What? Hishtalshalut. All right. You'll say it to your friend tomorrow and you'll be a top-notch Kabbalist. What does it mean? What's the definition? I'm reading from the book. The many degrees of systematic descent that stretch between God's desire to create the universe and the tangible result of that goal. So it's like this chain. It's referred to as Hishtalshalut in Kabbalistic lingo, and that is like the systematic devolution, let's just say, from God until he ended up with the end result of that desire, which was the world that we all know. All right. So, all good? Okay. One more still introductory idea. And that is that when we talk about, when we engage kind of in Kabbalah, when we swim in this world and we're talking about God and all these lofty ideas, there is a concern. And the concern is that you end up with, as someone referenced before, Madonna Kabbalah. Which means that the problem with engaging and discussing and studying these ideas, and by the way, that's why historically, did anyone ever hear of an idea, of a concept that people avoid studying Kabbalah till the age of 40? You ever heard of that? Okay, so that was in various other conditions. That was true historically, but not in recent history. And that's because in the last 300 years, since the Baal Shem Tov, who was the founder of the Hasidic movement, started to kind of distill Kabbalistic ideas and define them, and I'm talking about starting from him, but in the generations afterwards as well. So before all of that, if you just kind of studied raw Kabbalah, there was a risk that it would be taken out of context, which means that when we're studying these very spiritual, lofty ideas, the problem is that we only have one point of reference, and that is the physical reality. We're physical beings, so the only way we can talk about anything is in physical terms. So there is a fear that, and consider everything that we just spoke about for the last 15 minutes, that we look at the human body in order to understand God, right? So when we do that, we may end up with scenarios where we use human terms to understand God, because those are the only terms we can use. We don't know any other reality. We can't articulate anything in any other way. So we have to use these terms. But we need a reminder before we go in. Now, that's in text number 3, a short text here. Lou, want to read that for us, please?
The saintly Rabbi Israel Baal Shem Tov taught that when studying the works of Kabbalah, we must be careful not to perceive the Kabbalistic ideas as literal physical concepts.
Thank you. So, anyone ever hear of the children's series, Amelia Bedelia? Okay, so what was the problem there? That everything was taken very literally, right? I think we even have a slide describing it. Right there. So, she was told to put the lights out. So instead of turning off the lights, she took the bulbs and hung them out on the laundry line. She was putting the lights out. So there's a fear that when we study Kabbalah, we may also take things in a literal level, the way we are describing them, when the truth is we shouldn't be. In other words, we're going to be talking tonight about three worlds that transcend our world, and we'll come back to it shortly. But I want to let you know immediately that when we talk about worlds that are higher than ours, it does not mean that it's hovering over the sky. That would be a mistaken way to understand it. That would be applying physical terms to something spiritual. So what does it mean when we say higher? Well, in a company, there's a CEO and let's just say his secretary. Okay, who has a higher position? The CEO. Does that mean that he sits on a higher place or higher floor than the secretary? Of course not. It means higher in rank or in stature. That's how you're using the term. Similarly, when it comes to these ideas or anything divine or godly or spiritual, even when we use a term like higher, it doesn't mean higher. It just means higher conceptually. And we'll see what higher means. Usually it means more spiritual or more divine consciousness in that particular term. But the key is to make sure that we don't apply our physical perceptions to allow us to limit our understanding of the divine. So that's just a word of caution before we enter. Everything good? Makes sense? Okay. So let me just go back. Let me just go back to this question, because we started with a couple questions. We started with what is Kabbalah? We're starting to get an answer. And that is a sophisticated exploration of the order of devolution. We're trying to, what Kabbalah is, you need to just sum it up. It's there to help us understand how reality went from God to the world that we know. And we're using the term devolution because the closer you are to God, the higher and more divine consciousness there is. As you move lower towards the physical realm, it's considered a devolution because you're moving further away from God and divine consciousness. So that's what Kabbalah is, exploring this systematic devolution between God and us. Now, the how of Kabbalah, we just explained. Seder Hishtal Shalut consists of non-material realities. And because it's non-material, it's very important that we don't apply our materialistic understanding of it to these lofty ideas, even though the only way we can pursue and study them is with our own minds. Okay, now we said what is Kabbalah, we said how to go about studying Kabbalah, and now why should we even study this? And this is going to be the last thing before we get into the real meat of tonight's class. So the question is why? So let's just say, most people, certainly I for one, I know how to drive a car, according to most opinions, maybe not my family members. I know how to drive a car, but I have absolutely no clue how a car works. Okay, it's like the most cooking I can do is a coffee and scrambled eggs. With a car, the most I can do is maybe put in gas or put air in a tire. Anything beyond that is going to be somebody else or a mechanic. Now, would I even need to know how a car works? I don't really, right? I could live my whole life without knowing. But why would somebody like to know? Usually, it's in case there's an emergency. What if you're stuck alone, something goes wrong, and there's nobody around, and there's no AAA, and you can't just walk a block to figure it out? So if you know what you're doing, then you may be able to help the situation. If it happened to me, I would not know what to do and would have no clue what to do. So really, it's in case something goes wrong. That's when it helps to know what's going on and how it really works. So, why am I talking about this? Because when it comes to living our lives, okay? So, for generations, they did it without Kabbalah. However, when does it help to know Kabbalah? And of course, Kabbalah is more of like the inner workings. Meaning, you can be Jewish. All you need to know is how to drive the car. You just need to know how to be a Jew. You have to know how to wrap tefillin, how to eat kosher, how to observe Yom Kippur, how to observe Shabbat. That's all just information that you need to know how to live like a Jew. And if you know it, then you can do it. But Kabbalah digs deeper, kind of goes into the engine of things, of reality. It gets behind the scenes. Why would it be necessary to have this information? Really, in case of an emergency. Because if life isn't as smooth as it used to be back in the shtetl, where you didn't need to know much. You just needed to know how to be a Jew. And that was enough, and you can get through life. Today, it's not so easy. It's not so simple. We live in a big world, and we tend to have much easier to come across obstacles and breakdowns. So the question is, what do we do then? How do we go about it? How do you go about fixing the situation? So, generally speaking, as long as everything's okay, we don't need to. But when we do need it, it helps to know what's going on in the engine. And studying Kabbalah really is getting an understanding, not just how to live like a Jew, but really what's going on at the core. What's behind it? Why did God even create the world? What was His objective? What's the inside of reality? And when we study Kabbalah, and this is addressing the why we're studying it, when we have this information, then it helps us, it gives us insight, and it gives us the tools to be able to get through life even when the going gets tough. And it's a perfect time for everything that's going on around us to be delving into these ideas, because that's what Jews did always when the going got tough. They turned and looked even deeper into Jewish sources to see what we can extract, which could illuminate, which could be insightful, and help us advance in our day-to-day life. Okay. Any quick comments? Yes, Neil.
You mentioned that the reason we were, that the gentleman, or whoever you were talking about, fixing the car, was to fix the car. The reason why you want to learn how to, is to fix it. Another reason would be you can make money off it, and you can teach others and help others. Does that fit into this?
That's a great observation. I mean, yes, if you have information if you want to become a car mechanic, then you got to know how the thing works, most certainly, and then you'll be able to help others too. And you can even make a living off of it. Now, when it comes to Torah and Kabbalah, it's not something that somebody should be driven to make a living off of, but most certainly when somebody does gain deeper insight into anything, they're going to feel like they want to share it with other people. It's like getting a hold of a secret, and the first thing you do is you call your best friend and say, I have to share this with you, because I don't know how I lived without this information, and here it is for you. So most certainly, we should have that deep desire to want to share it. And by the way, that's what happened since the Baal Shem Tov. Once it started to be taught, then it started to be disseminated even more. And there's a whole history around this too. Maybe at some point we'll share something. Let's see, maybe at the end of the session, if we have a couple minutes. Yes?
Going back to the car analogy, is Kabbalah knowing how to fix the car, or Kabbalah is having Google Maps?
Well, Google Maps, you don't really have to know much. You just have to know your destination.
But it can help you to go effectively and where to go. Sometimes you may be lost. I'm saying I want to understand the impact of Kabbalah.
You can say that Kabbalah is a navigation system.
Correct.
But you, in order for it to be helpful to you, it's not just by punching in your destination and then you just close your eyes and it gets you there. It doesn't work that way. So yes, it's a navigation system. But you need to really invest yourself heart and soul, like we're all doing here, and then the information could be helpful to you when you need it most. And this is, people always say, right, when someone's connected to their faith deeply, then when they encounter some obstacle or challenge in life, then their faith helped them through it. The problem is when someone isn't really connected to their faith, they never really explored it or delved into it, and then suddenly they face a challenge, then you have to you're at the beginning. Then you have to start exploring then to try to figure out how it can help you out of it. So it's always better to, right? If you're clever, you explore it in advance. Hopefully you'll never need it in that way, but you'll be equipped.
Going back to the car. To me, the Torah is the car manual, right? So I may have some knowledge in the manual, which can be the Torah. I can find some of those. How is the overlapping between Kabbalah and
yes, the Torah? But what we're doing in this course, yeah. There's one thing when you encounter a problem that you open up, you Google it and say, what do I do? Meaning you're troubleshooting an issue. So over there, you're looking for the solution once you have the problem. That's not what we're doing. We're not looking for a specific solution. We are going to the very core, we're studying the engineering book, if you will.
The design book, not even the manual.
Correct. We're not looking to troubleshoot a specific issue that we encountered. Other courses did that, by the way. We can first discuss issues, and then with that issue, you could look for a solution. That's not what we're doing in this course. In this course, we're exploring the very core of all this information. And then once we do that, and then we'll become certainly mini experts at Kabbalah, then we'll have what it takes to be able to address issues when we encounter them. All right. So with that, we will... We're going to advance here. And I think they're recommending that we take a look at our maps. Or you could also just look at the screen. And on the map, this is the bottom of the left side. So, by the way, and also that you see a number in the middle of the page. You see a number 1. That's because that's what's relevant for class number 1 on the bottom. Now, just so you understand... In this course, we're starting from the bottom. We said it's a devolution from God to us, but we're going to start from the bottom because the closer to us, the easier we can relate to it, and then we'll build on that in each class, and eventually we'll come to the top. But we're starting from the bottom. And the bottom is, of course, this physical world, and we'll see these are additional terms that we're going to be picking up right now are the name of 3 worlds. And the names of these 3 worlds are Bria, Yetzira, and Asiya. We'll talk more about them in a moment. We are in the world of Asiya. We're not going to dwell on this a lot tonight, but within the world of Asiya, there's two dimensions within it. We're the lower dimension of the world of Asiya, but for now, let's just take it that we're in Asiya. Then there's Yetzira, and then there's Bria. 3 worlds, which we're going to be exploring tonight. And we're starting from the bottom, and then we're going to move our way upward. Let's just take a look at this short passage from the Zohar. I think we're at Linda, is that correct? Could you please read that for us on page 9, text 4?
If I can remember how to pronounce it.
English.
Yeah. Oh, 4. God's glory includes Berea, and God bestowed this onto the kingdom. God's glory includes Yetzirah, and God bestowed this onto the human. God's glory includes, how do you say it?
Asiya,
and God bestowed this onto the human. Thus the human is rendered in the image of the supernal glory.
Thank you. So, what just happened here? We just said three terms. Okay, if you look up here, you see, in the Hebrew, we said bara, which means created. We said yatzar, which means fashioned. And then asa, which means made. Now, all these three terms are used in the process of creation. Can anyone recall any of them? Anyone know the first verse in the Torah? Second word is?
Bara.
Bereshit bara. That's the first term used for creation is bara, which means created. And then we come to the next term, which is yatzar, which is also used within the 6 days of creation, like vayatzar Hashem Elokim et Adam, God fashioned. That's another term used. And then we have the third term, which is asa. And that word appears just in Kiddush on Friday night, like three times. Right? Anyone know? Vayishbos bayom hashvi mikol malachta yasher asa. And then we say twice asa. Osa, exactly. Masa, yes, and then la'asot is the last word of the Kiddush before we say the blessing on the wine. All the same term, and they all means made. So, and don't worry, we'll explore this more, we'll understand the difference between them. So, these three terms are then go on to become terms that are used to define a whole world. So there's a world that's called Bria, which comes from the word Bara. There's a world called Yetzirah, which comes from the word Yatzar. And then Asiya comes from the third term, which means made. And that's the world that we hang out in. We're in the world of Asiya. Now, by the way, and here and there I'll interject, we're picking up another very important term right now in Kabbalah. The term, though, is actually one that includes all these three worlds. It's an acronym. Okay, it's on page 10 in your book. It's key term 1.2. Okay, and I'll tell you how to pronounce it first, then you'll say it with me. Bia. Can we say that?
Bia.
Bia. It's an acronym for Bria, Yetzira, Asiya. But if you're in having a Kabbalistic conversation, we use the term Bia as a whole. It refers to these three worlds. Now we'll talk about what these three worlds really are, how are they different from each other, and what are they about. So, here's the thing. We talked before how when God created the world, it was a process, and there was a beginning, and then a whole system. And we talked about how we go about whatever, acquiring or building a home or something else. So this process unfolded when God was ready to create the world. And the first thing that happened was Bria. And you remember we said before that God wanted a relationship, but you can't have a meaningful relationship when there is no other, when there's no entity other than yourself. You can't be in a relationship with yourself. So God wanted a relationship, but God's energy or presence was everywhere and filling every space. There wasn't even room for anything else. And we're not going to talk about tzimtzum or contraction tonight. That's not the topic tonight. But God needed to enter into a relationship, so he needed to go about creating something else, an other. So the first thing he did was Bria. Bria means that there was another existence that came into being.
A creature, isn't it?
Bria means creation. Creature comes from creation.
But in Yiddish, it's a creature. In Yiddish, akatu bria.
But that's already like a slang term almost. Yes. So, but bria, the word itself, means just creation. And the first thing that God did was to create. Now, at this stage, there wasn't any specific defined creation yet. The first thing that happened was God created an entity outside of himself. But it didn't really have definition yet at this stage. Okay, we're going to be talking about three different worlds. At the first one, in the world of Bria, yes, there was now a new entity that came to be. God created existence outside of himself. But that's all there was at this stage. There was existence. Okay, just try to think of like an embryo that came into being. Does it have definition yet? No, it doesn't. Is there something that exists? Absolutely. There's something that exists. Just one term for a minute, on page 10 in your book also, and that is the word yeshut. In Kabbalistic lingo, the word yeshut comes from the word yesh, by the way. Yesh means that it's like present, it exists. So in Kabbalistic lingo, yeshut means, it means existence, that something exists. So in this world of Bria, something already exists. You can't say that there's nothing. You can't say anymore that there's God and nothing else. That's before Bria. Once there's Bria, there's something else there, although it remains very raw and very undefined at this stage. But it's still there. It's mild. Then you go to the next phase, the next world, which is Yetzira. And even the term fashioned even implies this, because you start to fashion something specific. I don't know how the whole story goes, or the whole joke goes, but somebody once approached God and said something like, you think you're the only one that could create? I can also create. So God says, oh, you can? Okay, show me, go create. So the guy takes some dirt, starts gathering dirt, and God says, no, use your own dirt. So once there's dirt, meaning God created this dirt, nothing, and then it became something. That's the first step. That's Bria, where there was nothing and now there's something. Then once something exists, you can take that something and fashion it into something else. You can make something out of it, which is like what that fellow wanted to do. He wanted to take God's dirt and then create something from that. Okay, that's no big deal. We can all do that. Or some of us can, in some ways. But to create something from nothing, that is God's domain, and that's the world of Bria. So it starts as an embryo, then it evolves into a fetus where it has more definition, but still, it's still, yes, you could identify body parts, etc., gender, etc., but it isn't until full term with this full physical maturity. So it goes through this process. We all know about the debate about when life begins, right? But the Jewish mother says life begins
graduating medical school.
Graduating medical school, exactly. So, three stages of development. So, three stages of development. The Bria is like corresponds to the embryo. The next world, the world of Yetzira, corresponds to the fetus, and then the world of Asiya is once there's full physical maturity, that's where something is already fully defined and present and developed, and it has details and etc. So these are the three worlds that exist in this process, from God's existence alone, and then God starting the process of creation until there's actual physical reality that we are all familiar with. So, you know what? You can take a look at figure 1.4 on page 11. We can look at it together, and it gives us a little more information about Bria, Yetzira, Asiya, kind of like a chart, how it's translated, created, shaped, and then made, where it's complete. By the way, I didn't specify that the term Asa that we say in Kiddush, why are we using that term in Kiddush? Because Kiddush is the end of 6 days of creation. We only use the term made once it's fully made. So once God completed his work and the 6 days of creation were done, that's when he used the third term of Asa. It wouldn't be an appropriate term to use in the middle of the 6 days. At that point, there's still Bria and Yetzira going on. Things are coming into existence that didn't exist before. And things are being fashioned or formed that did exist but are being fashioned into specific entities. But then Asa is only appropriate at the culmination, which is when we celebrate Shabbat. To help us understand this a little bit better, am I making sense so far? Is everyone with me on the three phases? Okay, so to help us understand it a little bit better, and we do have a lot to cover, even though I already tried to condense things, and I still will, but we still have a lot, so just bear with me. So let's just talk about, I mean, we started talking about the embryo, fetus, and full physical maturity. Let's just move along here. I think we kind of looked at this in the chart. The names of Bria, creation of something from nothing, that's Bria. Just going to review this. The final existence, that is, in its perception outside of God. The first existence that's outside of God. And it's very important to remember this. That Bria is the first, that's the first existence that's outside of God. So, up until Bria, it's all God. Up until Bria, it's all God, exclusively. And once there's Bria, then there's something that's the first existence that's outside of God. And then, the world of Yatzar is giving shape to a pre-existing entity, and the pre-existing identity starts to develop and become defined. Finally, Asa, completing a task, complete independence and self-awareness emerge. So, to understand this a little bit better, we can look at it in two ways. Let's look at it this way first. So, anyone who's a parent is could relate to the concept that when a child is born, then at the earlier stages, they're 100% dependent on their parents for everything, and all their needs are met by their parents. And even though they kind of begin to be aware of and have a sense of self, even a young child can have a sense of self. We can say something to a child and they could say no. But nonetheless, they're still 100% dependent on their parents. And then they grow a little older, and then they start to develop a little bit more of a sense of self, and they become a little bit more independent. And eventually, raise your hand if you have a teenager in your home. Okay. And eventually, they start becoming even more independent. Now, they think they can be fully independent at a certain point, but they still need their parents. But the question is, what's the greatest gift that we can give our children?
Independence.
Is independence. It's not always the easiest gift to give. For some parents, it's very difficult to give our children independence. But the greatest gift we can give them is independence so that they can become their own person. Now, and become self-sufficient. Exactly. That's what we really want. And that's what they need to end up being. The thing is, so in this process of them growing up and with time developing more and more independence, their level of independence is going to be dependent on how much space the parent is ready to give them. In order for them to have independence, we need to give them space. And when we don't give them space, then they can't really become their own people. The more we back off, and sometimes it takes a lot of intention. Sometimes it has to be very purposeful. We have to do so intentionally. And we have to kind of back off and give them space. It doesn't always come naturally. But when we do, the more we do, the more they will emerge as a more developed and a developed individual. And they'll have their own ideas, their own self-perception will be evolved. They'll know what they want, and etc., etc. So what we're trying to get to here is this. In these three worlds of Bria, Yetzira, Asiya, the question is, what makes one? Why? I know we gave these definitions to them, and in one, existence just came into being, and in the next one, it's starting to be formed more, and in the third one, it's already fully evolved. Well, why is that happening? Why isn't it all happening in Bria? Or for that matter, why isn't it all happening in Asiya? What's the difference between each one of these three phases that makes room for there to be additional steps in reality and existence coming into being?
They all depend on each other.
But what would define the difference between one and the next?
Foundation.
Time. Growth.
Structure.
Growth.
The degree of self-awareness.
What defines what's causing a greater degree of self-awareness when you devolve and go from one level to a lower one? What's behind it? So Larry's pointing upward. And that's over here in this text, which I'm not going to read, but it's right there in text number 5. But the point is that just like these parents, when is this child able to become more independent and identify themselves more and realize more of themselves? When the parent gives them space, the more the parent withdraws, the more the child is able to identify with their sense of self and to evolve and develop themselves more. So it's dependent on the parent withdrawing. So the difference in between these three worlds is, to what degree is God's presence overwhelming and dominant? So in the world of Bria, where that's the highest and closest to God, again, when we say close, it doesn't mean close physically. Why are we using the term close? Because God's presence is still dominant in Bria. Yes, that's the first existence came to be on that level, as we explained before, but it's still just the first, it's the first existence. It's like the embryo. It just came into being. But God's presence, or think of the child. The child is already an entity of their own, but is fully 100% dependent on the parent. Similarly, in the world of Bria, God's presence is dominant and it's overwhelming. If God's presence is overwhelming, then existence is not going to develop a whole lot, because there isn't space for another entity to develop more. But when you devolve another level to Yetzira, where God's presence is more withdrawn, because you go further away, so God's presence is more withdrawn, God, so to speak, is making space for something else. So it evolves even further. And even more so in the world of Asiya, and the third level, in the third world, where God's presence is almost totally obscured, and in our world here, fully obscured, and that's why in this world we have physical existence the way we do. In fact, somebody could live their whole life believing that there is no God, and he doesn't come from anywhere. How is that even possible? How should someone live their entire life without recognizing the fact that they were created by something or someone? That's only because God created that possibility by withdrawing his presence on this level, in our reality here. God withdrew his presence 100% to the degree that there could be somebody who could think that he doesn't even come from God. But again, this process happens slowly. Just like that child who's being brought up by parents, the more the parents withdraw and create space, the more they are going to mature, develop, and find their own independence. So as we devolve from one world to the next, what's really happening is the reality is becoming more and more independent from God, because that's how God wanted it. God withdrew his presence. And the more he does, the more reality identifies with itself.
So this concept of separation, individuation, really started with God, number one, and number two, isn't it the separation created by God so that we could then cleave back?
So that he could be in a relationship. He needs us to be 100% other and independent in order to have a meaningful relationship. If the world of Bria chooses God, what's the big deal? It basically, all it knows is God. Yes, there's an embryo, or there's a, it's like a child that's just born, but all it knows is its parents. When there's an adult child that's totally independent, has his own home, and he's making a living, and he doesn't need his parents for anything, and then he still wants to be in a relationship with his parent and recognizes everything that they gave them, that the parent gave them from birth till they became their own person. How meaningful is that? That's incredible. But that's because the adult is choosing that relationship and is expressing that appreciation and recognition for the one that brought them up. But that is most meaningful when it comes from an 100% independent entity. And that's only in this world. Now, that said, even though we live in a Asiya reality, so over here it's kind of presented as different teenagers based on the level of how much space the parent gave the child. I used it more just in the same child kind of being brought up, but it just makes the case. Based on the level of involvement and how much the parents assert themselves into the life of the child, that's going to be the degree of independence that they develop. Now that said, there is an important thing to remember, and that is that even though we live in the world of Asiya and we're totally physical and we're totally independent from God, however. By the raise of hand, and you don't have to share what the experience was, but raise your hand if you ever had an experience where you were overwhelmed by the presence of God. If that ever happened to you, just raise your hand. Okay, a decent number of you. So, in one word, if you want to describe that moment, you could call it a Bria moment. Okay, if you had a moment when you were overwhelmed by the presence of God, that was like what it's like in the world of Bria, where God's presence is totally overwhelming and you kind of lose yourself. What does it mean that you lose yourself in the moment? When you lose yourself, sometimes it could happen to someone during prayer. They can lose themselves and they're totally consumed in connection to God. That is like a Yetzira or even a Bria moment. Somebody who was in Israel on October 7th, who comes here regularly. So he returned the following Friday and was here Shabbat 2 weeks ago. Some of you may have been here at that Kiddush lunch where he shared a few words. And he said that they were in Israel for the end of Sukkot. And a couple days later, a day or two later, on the 7th or the 8th, he got a call from a friend of his from Houston, who he's friends with, called him and told him that his son was unfortunately shot on October 7th. And the parents are here. But they had this friend who's now in Israel, someone that lives in Bel Air, and he said, I don't even know which hospital my son is in, but you're in Israel. Maybe you could figure it out. So anyway, with the help of his daughter, who's in medical school, they did figure it out. And he and his wife went to the boy's hospital room, and they were with the boy for like 36 hours until the father arrived from Houston. Now, thank God he's doing okay. I mean, he was shot in the shoulder, and I believe it hit his jaw as well. Anyway, long story short, this when the friend was back here and sharing this experience, he said that the boy's jaw needed to be closed because it needed to recover. So I guess it's locked shut. So he was communicating with writing, and this is very much not a religious family, Jewish of course, but not they wouldn't call themselves religious. But the boy wrote in the hospital. So the story was that he was in a helicopter, and I think something happened to the helicopter. I don't know if it was done by the terrorists or not, but they had to land emergency. Once they landed and they got out, that's when he was shot. And he said when he was in the helicopter, this is what he wrote, he said he like felt the presence of God. And it was very surprising coming from him, because this is not like a family who you would typically hear such terms. Now, I didn't meet him yet, so I don't have any details on what this means. But when somebody has an experience of that nature, that they were overwhelmed by the presence of God, we can call that a Bria moment. And this boy had it at that particular time, where he was overcome with God's presence. That's what the world of Bria is like. Usually, just in the world of Asiya, we don't usually have such moments, because we are in a reality where God's presence is withdrawn, where the parent is withdrawn, removed from the scene, and allowing us to become independent people. But, like I said, here and there we could have it. And that's what we would call something more Bria-like. Okay. There is a short video, but I watched the video, and to be honest, it doesn't really give us new information. It just kind of summarizes what we discussed so far, so I think it's a waste of 5 minutes, personally, meaning you could see it afterwards. I'll send it out in the email, but I'm going to skip it if that's okay with you. If everyone wants to see it, okay, we'll jump over it. So, where are we here? State of mind, Tzira reality, God feels somewhat distant from us. Yetzira reality, sensing God's presence to some degree. And then in Bria, you can be overwhelmed by his presence. That would be a Bria-like moment. I'm going to skip the video. And now we're going to kind of advance to the last segment of tonight's discussion. Any very quick comment or question? Is everything good? Are you with me? Yes.
Yeah, well, just the mention of Betul here, because I don't know if we're about to go over that, but when it translates that surrender as subdued sense of self due to being absorbed by something overwhelmingly impressive, would you say that in the state of Bria, Betul is...
Correct. So I jumped over one of the terms, and that may happen, by the way. That's why you have it in your book and on the map, depending on the time constraints. But yes, there was a term that I did not touch upon, which is bitul, which means like surrender. The terms it gives here is surrender, suspension, or nullification, like self-nullification. What it basically means is like the suspension of ego. That's what bitul means. So where you can use the term, basically, if somebody is having a Bria moment, or the world of Bria is a world where there is a very strong sense of Bitul. Because even though there is an entity that was created, it still doesn't have a very strong sense of self. It's still basically surrendered to the reality it's in, which is basically overwhelmingly divine and divine energy. To nullify, yes, yeah, same word. In Kabbalistic terms, it means less self, more God. Right? Ego stands for edging God out. Less ego, suspension of ego, is the meaning of bitul, meaning less self, which means more room for God. Okay. So, I'm trying to just see, I want to make the best out of the little time we have left. So, there may be a lot of information here, but you'll forgive me. Okay, let's kind of go over to... So, now the question is, we just talked about these three worlds. What we really want to do for the next 15 minutes is try to understand what these three worlds mean to us. We started out saying that everything that we study in Kabbalah really, number one, has to be translated into our own lives. But first, we also have to see where we find these three worlds within ourselves. We said before that by looking deep in, we can gain an appreciation for God. By studying our own character, our own image, we understand God's image. So what do these three worlds mean within us? Something quick?
Yeah, just how does this, so if you have, let's say, a moment of like deja vu, or a moment that doesn't quite make sense but is happening, is that a sign of being closer to, what's it called? Yeah.
Bria.
No, that's
it depends. If you lost yourself in that moment and you feel the presence of even someone else, then yes, it may be a more of a powerfully divine moment. If someone's feeling very much of their own presence, I wouldn't necessarily call it otherworldly. As far as,
well, deja vu in and of itself is something that doesn't, like, how, like, I can't say that I've ever been here in this class with these people, with you instructing us on Kabbalah, and then let's just say I'm like, but I really was, I feel like I was. You see what I'm saying? Like, how is that, was that related at all? And we've all had those experiences. I don't know.
I didn't come across it in Kabbalah yet. Okay. Okay, could you do the following for me? Can everybody say after me, 2 + 2 = 5? Okay. Could you think also? Think 2 + 2 = 5, okay? Now, you don't have to in reality, but you could write 2 + 2 = 5 as well, right? Okay. Now, could you now understand that 2 + 2 = 5?
No.
Why not? You just thought it. Why can't you understand it? Because it's not. Okay. So this will help us understand the next idea. And that is that these three worlds, Bria, Yetzirah, Asiya, the way we apply them to ourselves, are going to be referred to, all of them together are going to be referred to as garments of the soul. Okay? That's another term. I'm not sure where it is exactly. Yes, it's on page 14. Levushe HaNefesh means garments of the soul. Levushim means garments, right? Anyone with Hebrew here? Malbush, levush means a garment. These three worlds within us are going to be referred to as garments. Specifically, what are the garments of the soul? So we're going to identify them as thought, speech, and action. Okay? Thought, speech, and action. Those are the garments of the soul. Now, why are we calling them garments? We're calling them garments because if my white shirt gets dirty, which happens, you know, when you have children and you wear white shirts, your shirt can get dirty. The good news is that you're not stuck with the shirt. You can take it off and put on a different one. And that's true about anyone with any garment. You don't have to keep the garment that you're wearing on. Garments could be changed. That's the good news. When we call thought, speech, and action, when we call them garments of the soul, why are we calling them garments? Because they can all be changed. They're not the soul itself. You have the soul, then you have the garments of the soul. What did we just do now? We thought that 2 + 2 = 5. Okay, that's one garment, is thought. We spoke it, we articulated it, and then I can also write it on a paper. That's like action. So thought, speech, and action, I can use all three of them for 2 + 2 = 5. But the moment I ask you to understand it, we're done. Because you can't understand it. Understanding is the soul itself. Understanding, which in Hebrew is called sechel, you may be familiar with. Sechel means intellect. Intellect is not a garment of the soul. Intellect is the soul itself. And there's no way for the soul to understand something that's not intelligent. So the soul can't understand or grasp 2 + 2 = 5 because it's unintelligent, so it's not going to. But you could still think it. Why? Because thought is a garment. Speech is a garment. Action is a garment of the soul. It's a garment the soul uses, but it's not the soul itself. Okay? Is this...
What about consciousness?
What do you mean by consciousness?
Well, I thought consciousness was really part of the soul.
Correct. consciousness should not be confused with thought.
Right.
Thought is like a tool. Consciousness is more associated, I think, with intelligence,
awareness.
Is it spiritual?
But what's that?
Is it spiritual?
What? Consciousness?
No.
I mean,
consciousness.
Yeah, I'm imagining that that's what you were referring to, right?
Right.
Right, but that's not thought. Thought is like a tool. It's a garment that the soul uses in order to relate. So, okay, so thought, speech, and action. What do we know about them, about these garments? So we know, number one, they can operate in ways that contradict your soul. Okay? So you can be thinking one thing, meaning you can be understanding one thing, which is your soul. Your soul understands, but you can be on the garments level, you can do the exact opposite. I can be thinking or understanding about somebody. I can have information about someone, I don't know, that they're not a good person, but I could still give them a compliment. Right? Why? Because I'm using a garment. I'm using my speech to say something nice to them, even though maybe they're not deserving of it, but I can use my garments to contradict the soul because it's just a garment. Just like if I have a bruise on my arm, it's not going to show up on my shirt because it's two different things. Just because something exists on me doesn't mean it's going to show up on my garment. The same is with the soul. Something could exist in the soul, but it doesn't mean that the garments are going to be expressing it. So they can operate in ways that contradict your soul. They can be easily changed. And they are referred to as levushim, garments of the soul. So, good?
Yes.
Okay, so let's advance a little bit, and I'm cutting to the chase a little bit because I do want to get to the end in the time that we have. With this information and with this understanding, we're now going to kind of translate this into kind of like what's in it for me. What does this information do for us? How does it enhance our lives? And like we started it, like we said in the beginning, that everything we study, every big idea in Kabbalah ultimately has to be translated and interpreted in a way that it could enhance my life and all of our lives. Exactly. What's the takeaway? And therefore, so here's the good news. By the way, you know the joke about the Jewish mother who was sent home from jury duty because she insisted that she was guilty. So human beings, we often struggle with our character, with our characteristics, with our tendencies, and sometimes we get frustrated with certain tendencies that we have or certain character traits. Maybe we can even call them character flaws. So if we can quickly look on page 22 at exercise 1.1, if you can, don't say anything, don't speak anything, just look at this list and try to identify something that presents a little bit of a challenge for you. Again, this is just for you. You don't have to share it. Whatever it could be, maybe, let's say I struggle with selfishness or insensitivity or whatever. So sometimes it really bothers us when we identify ourselves as such and we kind of struggle with the fact that I am X, Y, or Z and I have this character flaw, let's just say. So studying this idea that we studied tonight about these three worlds and how within us they represent the garments of the soul, and what we learned about garments, that garments could be switched and changed. So there's a lot of good news here tonight. And that is that even if my character, my soul, even if I'm challenged with a certain character trait, the good news is that it doesn't mean that I need to live that way. The good news is that I have garments that I'm able to employ That even if I struggle with a certain thing, let's just say I struggle with arrogance. Even if I struggle with arrogance, I could still act modestly. Just because I struggle with arrogance doesn't mean I need to be arrogant. Because when it comes to thought, speech, and action, which are garments of the soul, I can use them in ways that contradict the soul itself. So even if I have a certain character trait, let's say I'm a stingy person, I can intentionally act generous. And no one will ever know that I'm a stingy person. It will never come out. It doesn't have to come out. Now, this doesn't happen just by itself. It takes work. But if we want to live intentionally, we have the ability to use our garments in ways that don't reflect the soul itself. And our thought, speech, and action, these garments of the soul, they reflect, and I'm not going to dwell on this, I'm just going to state matter-of-factly, that they reflect the three worlds of Bria, Yetzira, and Asiya. And those three worlds are like God's garments. It's not God himself. God uses this system in order to bring about reality, as we discussed before. But it's outside of God himself. Similarly, these three garments are outside of our own soul, but we can use them for our benefit. We could use them in ways that may contradict the soul itself. My soul could be one thing, but my garment could still do something different. Yes? Is everyone relating to this? Okay, so that's takeaway number one from what we learned today about these three worlds and three garments that we have. Takeaway number one is just because I am something doesn't mean that's how I have to be and that's how I have to live and express myself. I can be something, but I could still actualize and express something totally different. And obviously we mean positively.
How long can you live in conflict with your soul?
It's not in conflict. You're doing the right thing.
But then you're not being stingy.
You're not being stingy, but it doesn't mean that your nature is... Now, the truth is that when you do something enough times, it starts to impact your soul. It doesn't change you 100%, because when someone's soul is a certain way, largely, they stay that way. It doesn't mean they have to be that way and live that way. But and some people do slowly change their nature. It becomes second nature, it's called, in Kabbalah. You could do that. You could develop that. But it takes a lot of time and it takes a lot of work. And I could be working on something for 10 years and I still didn't change myself over. But I still was acting generously for 10 years. And I should keep on doing it. Second nature becomes a habit, and that's great. If I do it enough and it becomes a habit, then I'm a winner.
So would you say your nature or some of these personality traits, that is part of your soul? So if you're
the character trait is part of our soul, as we'll be learning more in the subsequent weeks. Yes, but we can use the garments for our benefit, even if we're frustrated or challenged in a certain way. Something quick.
So going to the garment, it seems like I'm wearing a small size garment on a large body or soul. Is the soul, can be shaped the soul based on the garment? Can we shape the soul based on the garment? Because it seems like the...
Yes, the short answer is yes. The soul, it's usually not changed over radically, but you could impact, the garments could impact the soul. I'm going to wait with questions till we're done. I'm not rushing anywhere, but I do want to reach the finish line. So let's just move a little bit quicker here. So they have their own identity, as we said, and they correspond to Biyah. Even if my natural tendency leans toward arrogance, I could still act modestly. Even if my character is more cynical, I can still speak favorably of others. Even if my inclination is to be anxious, I can still think calming thoughts. By the way, this is true even about thoughts, not only about speech and action. I can even change my thoughts. Even if I'm overcome with thoughts of a certain type, like right now, a lot of us are overcome with fear and anxiety. But I can still, now, to say stop thinking something usually doesn't work. Because when you say stop, then you're going to think about it more. But you can switch your thoughts over to something else. If you're thinking about or watching something, a channel that's making you anxious, you can switch the channel. Or you can start reading a book or saying a prayer. And suddenly your thoughts are going to be switched over to something else. Okay, two more quick ideas. Idea number two is this, and I'm going to jump over this, but you do have this image. It just shows how thought, speech, and action is reflected in the word Adam, which means man or human. Okay, takeaway number two. If we want to get something done in life, it takes three steps. Three steps to making an important decision. What are they? It takes thinking, garment number one. We need to strategize, plan, which is thought. That's garment number one. If you want to do something, you have to plan it and strategize. Number two is consult with friends, experts, and mentors. That's speech. You have to speak it over with others. Okay, let's say you have to make a life decision. You're not sure if you should switch jobs. You're not sure if you should relocate to a different community. You're not sure if you can, if you should pull your child out of the school. So you're thinking about it. You have to think about it. You have to consult with people, with experts, with mentors. And then finally, you have to implement the decision into reality. Let's say you want to open a new business. You have to go through all these steps. The problem is that most people are not necessarily strong in all three of these. Usually, we're strong in one or in two. Some people are strong in all three. But if we're strong in two out of three, let's say somebody is a very, they have great ideas and they're a wonderful innovator. And they even know how to talk it over, but they don't know how to execute. So they get nowhere. They can have a brilliant mind with the greatest ideas. If they were able to execute all their great ideas, they would maybe be a billionaire today, but they just don't know how to. They just have this handicap. Conversely, you have other people who maybe they don't have great ideas. Maybe they learn from other people, but they know how to do the other phases. Also, you have people who are good in one, but they don't consult with anybody. Because I'm a smart guy, what do they know? They're not going to know anything that I don't. So why should I waste my time consulting with others? But in 3 years from now, I tell myself, if only I would have spoken to other people, maybe I wouldn't have wasted 3 years of my life in that job. So that's why it's very necessary to use each one of these three, to employ each one of our three garments at every important phase in life. And by the way, even the less important, we're always making small decisions every day. And we should use all three. Where do we learn this from? Who used all three of these phases in creation? God himself. God used all three. Bria, Yetzira, Asiya. The strategizing phase, the consulting phase, we know that God consulted with the angels about creation. We're not going to dwell on that right now. And then he executed, he actually created. So we too should employ all three whenever we are considering something important in life. And finally, one more usage of these three is the need for all three we already discussed that. We have three types of mitzvahs. There are some mitzvahs, good deeds that we do with our action. Putting a coin in the charity box is an act. Then you have other mitzvahs, which we use our speech. Right now we're studying Torah, we're using our words. And then by prayer, we use our intentions and our thoughts. So we need to connect with God in all different ways, utilizing all three garments of thought, speech, and action. And then, finally, to close, and this is where you have an additional piece of paper, which you should have found under your books when you sat down. And that is this. And because of the importance of all these three steps that we need to employ in our lives, so the way Judaism teaches us is that we actually use all three immediately first thing in the morning. And we have a daily preparation. We have this exercise of using our thought, speech, and action. All three garments of our soul are used immediately for a good thing. What does the code of Jewish law tell us in text number 10? I'm just going to read the first paragraph. We're on page 30, text number 10 from the code of Jewish law. As soon as we wake up, we should contemplate before whom we are lying. Okay, before we even wake up, meaning before we get out of bed, we just woke up, we opened our eyes, the first thing we should do is contemplate. We should think about the fact that we woke up and God gave us back our soul and we are starting a new day to serve our Creator, to serve God Almighty. That's the first thing we should think. And then we articulate it in words. And this is where you receive this page. And by the way, this is a gift to each of you to take home. and you can keep this near your bed or wherever you want on your refrigerator as a reminder of the first thing we do in the morning. After thinking it, we then say, Moda Ani, and we thank you, living and eternal King, for you have graciously restored my soul within me. Your faithfulness is great. That's the first thing we utter in the morning. And then, when we get out of bed, the first thing we do, the first action, is we wash our hands. And we purify ourselves, so to speak, just like the priest would do in the temple before starting his service before God. Every one of us, when we start our day, we are starting a day of serving God. So that's the first thing that we do. That's the first action. So we start with thought, we continue with speech, and we close with action, acting like God Almighty himself when he created the world. We employ all three of our garments in the best way possible right in the beginning of the day. And then that helps us continue throughout the rest of the day employing these garments for positive things only. Thank you very much. This formally concludes session number 1.